2 years from now, America will have attracted to itself the greater part of trade with China and the Indies, and will be enthroned between two oceans. The country possesses such elements of prosperity that one would have to be blind not to recognize them. I have no hesitation in saying that a Rothschild house, and not just an agency, should be established in America. Today we are presented with a fine opportunity. Later on, difficulties will of necessity arise as a result of competition from all sides. Some historians have expressed amazement over the fact that the recommendation was never acted upon. Wilson says, "This was the greatest opportunity the Rothschilds ever lost." Those with a more skeptical bent are tempted to wonder if the opportunity really was lost, or if it was merely taken in a more indirect fashion. It is significant that precisely at this time, George Peabody was making a name for himself in London and had established a close relationship with Nathan Rothschild. Is it possible that the Peabody firm was given the nod from the Rothschild consortium to represent them in America? And is it possible that the plan included allowing Belmont to operate as a known Rothschild agent while using Peabody and Company as an unknown agent, thus providing their own competition? John Moody answers, "The Rothschilds were content to remain a close ally of Morgan rather than a competitor as far as the American field was concerned." Gabriel Kolko says, "Morgan's activities in 1895 to 1896 in selling U.S. gold bonds in Europe were based on his alliance with the House of Rothschild." Serino Pratt says, "These houses may, like J.P. Morgan and Company, represent here the great firms and institutions of Europe, just as August Belmont and Company have long represented the Rothschilds." And George Wheeler writes, "Part of the reality of the day was an ugly resurgence of anti-Semitism. Someone was needed as a cover. Who better than J. Pierpont Morgan, a solid Protestant exemplar of capitalism, able to trace his family back to pre-revolutionary times?" Rise of the House of Morgan. With these considerations as background, the meteoric rise of Morgan's star over London and Wall Street can be readily understood. It is no longer surprising, for example, that Peabody and Company was the sole American investment firm to receive a gigantic loan from the Bank of England during the U.S. Panic of 1857, a loan which not only saved it from sinking, but made it possible to seize and salvage many other ships that were then capsized on Wall Street. Peabody had become active in the business of discounting acceptances, which is banker language for insuring commercial loans issued for the purchase of goods. This is how it works. The seller issues a bill with a stipulation that he must be paid at a future date, usually 90 days. When the buyer receives the bill, his bank writes the word "accepted" across the face of it and adds the signature of an officer, making it a legally binding contract. In other words, the bank becomes a co-signer on the buyer's credit and guarantees payment even if the buyer should default. Naturally, there is a price for this guarantee. That price is stated as a percentage of the total bill, and it is either added to the amount paid by the buyer or deducted from the amount received by the seller. Actually, there is a fee paid at both ends of the transaction, one to the seller's bank, which receives the acceptance and pays out the money, and one to the issuing bank, which assumes the liability of guaranteeing payment. The sale is said to be discounted by the amount paid to the banks. And so it was that Peabody and Company had been active in the business of discounting acceptances, primarily between sellers in England and buyers in the United States. Morgan and the Panic of 1857. In the Wall Street Panic of 1857, many U.S. buyers were unable to pay their bills, and Peabody and Morgan were expected to make good on their guarantees. Naturally, they didn't have the money, and the firm was facing certain bankruptcy unless the money could be obtained from somewhere. Stanley Jackson provides the details. The slump was catastrophic for Peabody and Company. It suddenly found itself committed to acceptances of £2 million, and with no hope of discharging even part of a stockpile of depreciating bonds on New York brokers and bankers, themselves now desperately short of ready funds. The firm was soon paying out thousands of pounds a day. Without raising a large temporary loan, the partners would be forced to suspend business altogether. Ron Chernow, in The House of Morgan, says, "Rumors raced through London that George Peabody and Company was about to fail, a prospect heartily relished by rivals. The major London houses told Morgan they would bail out the firm, but only if Peabody shut down the bank within a year." Jackson continues the narrative. "The clouds lifted dramatically when the Bank of England announced a loan to Peabody's of £800,000 at very reasonable interest, with the promise of further funds up to £1 million if and when required. It was a remarkable vote of confidence, as Thomas Hankey, governor of the Bank of England, had already rejected similar appeals from various American firms who did not measure up to his standards. Peabody and Company recovered almost overnight, and indeed hoisted its turnover above pre-slump levels." With an almost unlimited access to cash and credit backed by the Bank of England, Peabody and Morgan were able to wade hip-deep through the depreciated stocks and bonds that were sold to them at sacrifice prices on Wall Street. Within only a few years, when sanity had been restored to American markets, the assets of the firm had grown to gigantic proportions. This event tells us a great deal about relationships. If the Rothschilds truly had been competitors, they would have seized upon this opportunity and used their great influence within the Bank of England and the other investment houses in London to squeeze out Peabody, not to assist him. The Barings, in particular, were already trying to accomplish exactly that. The Rothschilds must have believed that a successful Peabody firm ultimately would be in their own best interest. Antisemitism was profitable. In later years, Jack Morgan, J.P. Jr., would assume the role of a staunch anti-Semite, and this undoubtedly strengthened his hand at dealing with American investors and borrowers who were loath to have anything to do with Jewish bankers. That, of course, included officials of the U.S. Treasury. It was particularly helpful during the 1896 rescue of the federal government from a decline in its gold reserves. Fearing that it would not be able to honor its promise to exchange paper money for gold coins, the government was forced to borrow $62 million in gold. The House of Rothschild was an obvious source for such a loan, but the Treasury wanted to avoid an anti-Semitic backlash. Everything fell into place, however, when Morgan and Company became the primary lender, with Rothschild apparently demoted to the role of a mere participant. Wheeler writes, "The consummate politicians of the Cleveland administration were certainly aware of the dangers inherent in promoting a rescue effort for the United States Treasury that would be financed by those archetypes of international Jewish financiers, the Rothschilds. During these developments, Pierpont Morgan took no direct part in the salvage effort. Up to this point, it looked as if the aging financier, he would be 58 in 2 months, would be merely one among many in this and whatever subsequent bond arrangements would be necessary. It seemed as though he would move on into old age with little more to round out his obituary than his awkward attempt to profiteer on the sale of rifles at the start of the Civil War, his minor shorting of the Union in gold trading toward the close, and a bold but largely unsuccessful move in the 1880s to impose an Eastern capitalist ceasefire on the country's warring railroads. But there were steps being taken even now to bring him out of the financial backwaters, and they were not being taken by Pierpont Morgan himself. The first suggestion of his name for a role in the recharging of the reserve originated with the London branch of the House of Rothschild. The apparent anti-Semitism of J.P. Morgan, Jr. was again extremely profitable during World War I, when it was widely publicized that the Kaiser was funded by German Jew bankers. To deal with the Morgan Group, therefore, as opposed to Kuhn Loeb, for example, was in some circles almost a point of national patriotism. When J.P. Morgan Sr. died in 1913, people were shocked to learn that his estate was valued at only $68 million, a paltry sum compared to the fortunes held by the Vanderbilts, Astors, and Rockefellers. It was even more unbelievable when Jack Morgan died in 1943 and left an estate valued at only $16 million. A small amount had been transferred to members of their families prior to their deaths, but that did not account for the vast fortunes which they visibly controlled during their lives. Surely there had been a bookkeeping sleight of hand. On the other hand, it may have been true. When Alphonse Rothschild died in Paris in 1905, it was revealed that his estate contained $60 million in American securities. The Rothschilds in Britain undoubtedly held an equally large block. Furthermore, many of these securities were handled through the House of Morgan. The possibilities are obvious that a major portion of the wealth and power of the Morgan firm was, and always had been, merely the wealth and power of the Rothschilds who had raised it up in the beginning and who sustained it through its entire existence. How much of Morgan's apparent anti-Semitism was real, and how much may have been a pragmatic guise, is, in the final analysis, of little importance, and we should not give unwarranted emphasis to it here. Regardless of one's interpretation of the nature of the relationship between the houses of Morgan and Rothschild, the fact remains that it was close, it was ongoing, and it was profitable to both. If Morgan truly did harbor feelings of anti-Semitism, neither he nor the Rothschilds ever allowed them to get in the way of their business. To put the London connection into proper perspective, it will be necessary, once again, to abandon a strict chronological sequence of events and jump ahead to the year 1924. So let us put our cast of characters on hold for a moment, and before allowing them to act out the drama of creating the Federal Reserve System, we shall pick up the storyline 11 years after that event had already taken place. England faces a dilemma. At the end of World War I, Britain faced an economic dilemma. She had abandoned the gold standard early in the war in order to remove all limits from the creation of fiat money, and the result had been extreme inflation. But now she wanted to regain her former position of power and prestige in the world's financial markets, and decided that to accomplish this, it would be necessary to return to the gold standard. It was decided further to set the exchange value of the pound sterling, the British monetary unit, at exactly $4.86 in U.S. currency, which was approximately what it had been before the war began. To say that she wanted to return to the gold standard actually is misleading. It was not a pure standard in which every unit of money was totally backed by a stated weight of gold. Rather, it was a fractional gold standard in which only a certain fraction of all the monetary units were so backed. But even that was much to be desired over no backing whatsoever, for three reasons. First, it created greater consumer confidence in the money system because of the implied promise to redeem all currency in gold, even though such promises are always broken when based on a fractional reserve. Secondly, it provided an efficient means of settling financial accounts between nations, gold always being the international medium of choice. Thirdly, it applied some breaking action to the production of fiat money, thus providing a certain degree of restraint to inflation and the boom-bust cycle. The decision to return to a fractional gold standard, therefore, while it left much to be desired, was still a step in the right direction. But there were two serious problems with the plan. The first was that the exchange value of gold can never be decided by political decree. It will always be determined by the interplay of supply and demand within the marketplace. Trying to fix the number of dollars which people will be willing to exchange for a pound sterling was like trying to legislate how many baseball cards a schoolboy will give for a purple agate. The international currency market is like a huge auction. If the auctioneer sets the opening bid too high, there will be no takers, which is exactly what happened to the pound. The other problem was that during the war, England had adopted a massive welfare program and a strong network of labor unions. The reason this was a problem was that the only way to make the pound acceptable in international trade was to allow its value to drop to a competitive and realistic level, and that would have meant not only a drastic reduction in welfare benefits, but also a general lowering of prices, including the price of labor, which is called wages. Politicians were quite willing to allow prices of commodities to move downward, but they did not have the courage to take any action which would reduce either welfare benefits or wages. To the contrary, they continued to bid for votes with promises of still more socialism and easy credit. Prices continued to rise. England in depression. With the value of the pound set artificially high in order to sustain prices, wages, and profit levels, the cost of British exports also became high, and they ceased to be competitive in world markets. With exports in decline, the amount of money coming into the country also declined. England became a debtor nation, which means that her payments to other countries were larger than her income from those countries. As pointed out in Chapter 5, if an individual spends more than his income, he must either increase his income, dip into savings, sell off assets, create counterfeit, or borrow. The same is true of nations. England had already borrowed to the limit of her credit and was rapidly exhausting her savings in order to continue purchasing foreign goods to sustain the high standard of living to which she had grown accustomed. She couldn't counterfeit because payments for these imports had to be settled in gold, which meant that as her national savings were spent, her gold supply moved out of the country. The handwriting was on the wall. If this process continued, the nation soon would be broke. It was a situation, incidentally, which was amazingly parallel to what has plagued the United States since the end of World War II, and for mostly the same reasons. By March of 1919, England's trade was so depressed that she had no choice but to let the value of the pound float, which means to seek its own level in response to supply and demand. Within a year, it had dropped to $3.21, a loss of 34%. Since the American dollar was the de facto world monetary standard at that time, receiving fewer dollars for each pound sterling meant that the pound was valued lower in all the markets of the world. The result was that the price Britishers had to pay for imported goods was becoming higher, while the price she received for the export of her own goods was becoming lower. The British economy was not only badly anemic, it was experiencing a monetary hangover from the vast inflation of World War I. In other words, it was undergoing a painful, but in the long run, healthy recovery and a return to reality. Such a condition was intolerable to the monetary and political scientists who were determined to find a quick and painless remedy which would allow the binge to continue. Several emergency therapies were administered. The first was to use the Financial Committee of the League of Nations, which England dominated, to require all the other European nations to follow similar inflationary monetary policies. They were also required to establish what was called the Gold Exchange Standard, a scheme whereby all countries based their currency not on gold, but on the pound sterling. In that way, they could all inflate together without causing a disruptive flow of gold from one to the other, and England would act as the regulator and guarantor of the system. In other words, England used the power of her position within the League of Nations to establish the Bank of England as a master central bank for all the other central banks of Europe. It was the prototype for what the cabal now is doing with the Federal Reserve and the World Bank within the framework of the United Nations. Problem of American prosperity. Europe was well in hand, but that still left the United States to be controlled. America had also inflated during the war, but not nearly as much. She also had a fractional gold standard, but the stockpile of gold was very large and still growing. As long as America continued to exist as the producer of so many commodities that England needed for import, and as long as the value of the dollar continued to be high, the anemia of the pound sterling would continue. The therapy chosen for this problem was simple. Perform a monetary transfusion from a healthy patient to the unhealthy one. All the London financiers had to do was find a large and robust specimen who, without asking too many questions, would be willing to become the donor. The specimen selected, of course, was Uncle Sam himself. It was the prototype of the transfer mechanism previously described, which has been the life support keeping alive the moribund communist and socialist countries since World War II. There are several ways the lifeblood of one nation can be transfused to another. The most direct method, of course, is to make an outright gift, such as the bizarre American ritual called foreign aid. Another is to make a gift disguised as something else, such as needlessly stationing military bases abroad for the sole purpose of bolstering the foreign economy, or granting a loan to a foreign government at below market rates, or worse, with the full expectation that the loan will never be repaid. But the third way is the most ingenious of them all: to have one nation deliberately inflate its currency at a rate greater than the other nation, so that real purchasing power, in terms of international trade, moves from the more inflating to the less inflating nation. This is a method truly worthy of monetary scientists. It is so subtle and so sophisticated that not one in a thousand would even think of it, much less object to it. It was therefore the ideal method chosen in 1925 to benefit England at the expense of America. As Professor Rothbard observed, in short, the American public was nominated to suffer the burdens of inflation and subsequent collapse, the crash of 1929, in order to maintain the British government and the British trade union movement in the style to which they insisted on becoming accustomed. At the inception of the Federal Reserve System, there had been a brief struggle for power, but within a few years the contest was decisively won by the head of the New York Bank, Benjamin Strong. Strong, it will be recalled, previously had been head of Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, and was one of the six participants at the secret meeting on Jekyll Island. Professor Quigley reminds us that Strong owed his career to the favor of the Morgan Bank. He became governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York as the joint nominee of Morgan and Kuhn Loeb and Company. Strong was the ideal choice for the cartel. Not the least of his qualifications was his alliance with the financial powers of London. When Montague Norman was made the governor of the Bank of England in 1920, there began a close personal relationship between the two central bankers, which lasted until Strong's sudden death in 1928. Norman was considered by many to be eccentric, if not mentally unbalanced. Quigley says, "Norman was a strange man whose mental outlook was one of successfully suppressed hysteria or even paranoia. He had no use for government and feared democracy. Both of these seemed to him to be threats to private banking, and thus to all that was proper and precious in human life. When he rebuilt the Bank of England, he constructed it as a fortress prepared to defend itself against any popular revolt, with the sacred gold reserves hidden in deep vaults below the level of underground waters, which could be released to cover them by pressing a button on the governor's desk. For much of his life, Norman rushed about the world by fast steamship, covering tens of thousands of miles each year, often traveling incognito, concealed by a black slouch hat and a long black cloak under the assumed name of Professor Skinner." Norman had a devoted colleague in Benjamin Strong. In the 1920s, they were determined to use the financial power of Britain and of the United States to force all the major countries of the world to go on the gold standard, with an artificial value set for the benefit of England, and to operate it through central banks free from all political control, with all questions of international finance to be settled by agreements by such central banks without interference from governments. Strong and Norman spent many holidays together, sometimes in Bar Harbor, Maine, but usually in southern France, and they crisscrossed the Atlantic on numerous other occasions to consult with each other on their plan for controlling the world economy. Lester Chandler tells us, "Their associations were so frequent and prolonged, and their collaboration so close, that it is still impossible to determine accurately their relative roles in developing some of the ideas and projects that they shared." The Bank of England provided Strong with an office and a private secretary during his visits, and the two men kept in close contact with each other through the weekly exchange of private cables. All of these meetings and communiques were kept in strict secrecy. When their frequent visits drew inquiries from the press, the standard reply was that they were just friends getting together for recreation or informal chats. By 1926, the heads of the central banks of France and Germany were occasionally included in their meetings, which, according to Norman's biographer, were more secret than any ever held by Royal Arch Masons or by any Rosicrucian order. Secret Meeting of 1927. The culmination of these discussions took place at a secret meeting in 1927, at which it was agreed that the financial lifeblood of the American people would be donated for a massive transfusion to Great Britain. Galbraith sets the scene. On July 1, 1927, the Mauritania arrived in New York with two notable passengers, Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England, and Hjalmar Schacht, head of the German Reichsbank. The secrecy covering the visit was extreme and, to a degree, ostentatious. The names of neither of the great bankers appeared on the passenger list. Neither, on arriving, met with the press. In New York, the two men were joined by Charles Rist, the deputy governor of the Banque de France, and they went into conference with Benjamin Strong, the governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The principal, or in any case the ultimately important, subject of discussion was the persistently weak reserve position of the Bank of England. This, the bankers thought, could be helped if the Federal Reserve System would ease interest rates, encourage lending. Holders of gold would then seek the higher returns from keeping their metal in London. And, in time, higher prices in the United States would ease the competitive position of British industry and labor. Galbraith speaks with soft phrases to cushion a harsh reality. What he is saying is that the purpose of the meeting was to finalize a plan whereby the governor of the Federal Reserve System was to deliberately create inflation in the U.S. so that American prices would rise, making U.S. goods less competitive in world markets and causing American gold to move to the Bank of England. Governor Strong needed little convincing. That is precisely what he and Norman had planned to do all along, and in fact he had already begun to implement the plan. The purpose of inviting the Germans and the French to the meeting was to enlist their agreement to create inflation in their countries as well. Schacht and Rist would have no part of it and left the meeting early, leaving Strong and Norman to work out the final details between them. Strong was more concerned about British fortunes than American. In a letter written in May of 1924 to Secretary of the Treasury Andrew Mellon, he discussed the necessity of lowering American interest rates as a step toward money expansion, with the objective of raising American prices relative to those in Great Britain. He acknowledged that the goal was to protect England from having to cut back on wages, profits, and welfare. He said, "At the present time, it is probably true that British prices for goods internationally dealt in are, as a whole, roughly in the neighborhood of 10% above our prices, and one of the preliminaries to the re-establishment of gold payment by Great Britain, will be to facilitate a gradual readjustment of these price levels before monetary reform is undertaken. In other words, this means some small advance in prices here and possibly some small decline in their prices. The burden of this readjustment must fall more largely upon us than upon them. It will be difficult politically and socially for the British government and the Bank of England to face a price liquidation in England, in face of the fact that trade is poor and they have over 1 million unemployed people receiving government aid. Bringing down the dollar. The Mandrake mechanism of the Federal Reserve went into high gear on behalf of the Bank of England in 1924, several years before the historic meeting between Strong, Norman, and Riest. There were two great surges of monetary expansion. The first came with the monetization of $492 million in bonds, plus almost twice as much in bankers' acceptances. The second burst of inflation came in the latter half of 1927, immediately following the secret meeting between Strong, Norman, Schacht, and Riest. It involved the funding of $225 million in government bonds, plus $220 million in bankers' acceptances, for a total increase in bank reserves of $445 million. At the same time, the rediscount rate to member banks, the interest rate they pay to borrow from the Fed, was lowered from 4 to 3.5%, making it easier for those banks to acquire additional reserves out of which they could create even more fiat dollars. The amount created on top of that by the commercial banks is about 5.5 times the amount created by the Fed, which means a total money flood in excess of $10 billion in just 6 years. Throughout this period, the demand by the system for government bonds and acceptances pushed interest rates down. As anticipated, people with gold then preferred to send it to London, where it could earn a higher yield, and America's gold supply began to move abroad. Furthermore, as inflation began to eat its way into the purchasing power of the dollar, the prices of American-made goods began to rise in world markets, making them less competitive. U.S. exports began to decline. Unemployment began to rise. Low interest rates and easy credit led to speculation in the securities markets, and the system lunged full speed ahead toward the great crash of 1929. But that part of the story must wait for another chapter. The technician who actually drafted the final version of the Federal Reserve Act was H. Parker Willis. After the system was created, he was appointed as first secretary of the Board of Governors. By 1929, he had become disillusioned with the cartel, and in an article published in the North American Review, he wrote, "In the autumn of 1926, a group of bankers, among whom was one with a world-famous name, were sitting at a table in a Washington hotel. One of them raised the question whether the low discount rates of the system were not likely to encourage speculation. 'Yes,' replied the conspicuous figure referred to, 'they will, but that cannot be helped. It is the price we must pay for helping Europe.'" There can be little doubt that the banker in question was J.P. Jack Morgan, Jr. It was Jack who was imbued with English tradition from the earliest age, whose financial empire had its roots in London, whose family business was saved by the Bank of England, who spent 6 months out of every year of his later life as a resident of England, who had openly insisted that his junior partners demonstrate a loyalty to Britain, and who had directed the Council on Foreign Relations, the American branch of a secret society dedicated to the supremacy of British tradition and political power. It is only with that background that one can fully appreciate the willingness to sacrifice American interests. Indeed, it is the price we must pay for helping Europe. In spite of the growing signs of crisis in the American economy, Morgan's protege, Benjamin Strong, was nonetheless pleased with his accomplishment. In a letter to Parker Gilbert, who was the American agent for reparations, he said, Our policy of the last 4 years, up to this January, has been effective in accomplishing the purpose for which it was designed. It has enabled monetary reorganization to be completed in Europe, which otherwise would have been impossible. It was undertaken with the well-organized hazard that we were liable to encounter a big speculation and some expansion of credit. Our course was perfectly obvious. We had to undertake it. The conditions permitted it, and the possibility of damage abroad was at a minimum. Damage abroad? What about damage at home? It is clear that Strong saw little difference between the two. He was the forerunner of the internationalists who have operated the Federal Reserve ever since. He viewed the United States as but one piece in a complex world financial structure, and what was good for the world was good for America. And, oh yes, what was good for England was good for the world. The British American Union. It is one of the least understood realities of modern history that many of America's most prominent political and financial figures, then as now, have been willing to sacrifice the best interests of the United States in order to further their goal of creating a one-world government. The strategy has remained unchanged since the formation of Cecil Rhodes Society and its offspring, the Round Table Groups. It is to merge the English-speaking nations into a single political entity, while at the same time creating similar groupings for other geopolitical regions. After this is accomplished, all of these groupings are to be amalgamated into a global government, the so-called Parliament of Man. And guess who is planning to control that government from behind the scenes? This strategy was expressed aptly by Andrew Carnegie in his book Triumphant Democracy. Expressing concern that England was in decline as a world power, he said, "Reunion with her American children is the only sure way to prevent continued decline. Whatever obstructs reunion, I oppose. Whatever promotes reunion, I favor. I judge all political questions from this standpoint. The Parliament of Man and the Federation of the World have already been hailed by the poet, and these mean a step much farther in advance of the proposed reunion of Britain and America. I say that as surely as the sun in the heavens once shone upon Britain and America united, so surely is it one morning to rise, shine upon, and greet again the reunited state, the British American Union." Summary. After the Civil War, America experienced a series of expansions and contractions of the money supply, leading directly to economic booms and busts. This was the result of the creation of fiat money by a banking system which, far from being free and competitive, was a halfway house to central banking. Throughout the chaos, one banking firm, the House of Morgan, was able to prosper out of the failure of others. Morgan had close ties with the financial structure and culture of England, and was, in fact, more British than American. Events suggest the possibility that Morgan and Company was in concealed partnership with the House of Rothschild throughout most of this period. Benjamin Strong was a Morgan man and was appointed as the first governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which rapidly assumed dominance over the system. Strong immediately entered into close alliance with Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England, to save the English economy from depression. This was accomplished by deliberately creating inflation in the U.S., which caused an outflow of gold, a loss of foreign markets, unemployment and speculation in the stock market, all of which were factors that propelled America into the crash of 1929 and the Great Depression of the 30s. Although not covered in this chapter, it must be remembered that the same forces were responsible for American involvement in both world wars to protect the economic and military resources England needed to survive. Furthermore, the key players in this action were men who were part of the network of a secret society established by Cecil Rhodes for the expansion of the British Empire. Chapter 21. Competition is a sin. The story of how the New York investment bankers formed a cartel to avoid competition. The drafting of proposed legislation to legalize that cartel. The strategy to camouflage the true nature of the legislation. The failure of the deception and the defeat of the bill. We have traveled to many points on a large circle of time and now are reapproaching the journey to Jekyll Island, where this book began. In the last chapter, we saw how the expansion and contraction of the money supply following the Civil War led to a series of booms and busts. We saw how the firm of J.P. Morgan & Company, with help from financiers in London, was able to reap great profits from both sides of those cycles, but particularly from the recessions. At that point, we jumped ahead in time to examine how J.P. Morgan and other leading American financiers were closely aligned with British interests. We also saw how, in the 1920s, the American dollar was deliberately weakened by Morgan agents within the Federal Reserve System in order to prop up the sagging British economy. Let us return now to the point of departure and allow our cast to resume playing out that most important prior scene, the actual creation of the Federal Reserve System itself. Halfway House to Central Banking. Historians seeking to justify governmental control of the monetary system have claimed that the booms and busts that occurred during this period were the result of free and competitive banking. As we have seen, however, these destructive cycles were the direct result of the creation and then extinguishing of fiat money through a system of federally chartered national banks, dominated by a handful of firms on Wall Street, which constituted a halfway house to central banking. None of these banks were truly free of state control, nor were they competitive in the traditional sense of the word. They were, in fact, subsidized by the government and had many monopolistic privileges. From the perspective of bankers on Wall Street, however, there was a great deal more to be desired. For one thing, America still did not have a lender of last resort. That is banker language for a full-blown central bank with the power to create unlimited amounts of fiat money, which can be rushed to the aid of any individual bank that is under siege by its depositors wanting their money back. Having a lender of last resort is the only way a bank can create money out of nothing and still be protected from a potential run by its customers. In other words, it is the means by which the public is forced to pay a hidden tax of inflation to cover the shortfall of fractional reserve banking. That is why the so-called virtue of a lender of last resort is taught with great reverence today in virtually all academic institutions offering degrees in banking and finance. It is one of the means by which the system perpetuates itself. The banks could now inflate more radically and more in unison than before the war, but when they pushed too far and too fast, their bank-generated booms still collapsed into recessions. While this could be highly profitable to the banks, it was also precarious. As the American economy expanded in size, the magnitude of the booms and busts increased also, and it was becoming more and more difficult for firms like Morgan & Company to safely ride out the storm. There was a growing dread that the next collapse might be more than even they could handle. In addition to these concerns was the fact that many state banks, mostly in the developing southern and western states, had elected not to join the national banking system and consequently had escaped control by the Wall Street-Washington axis. As the population expanded south and westward, much of the nation's banking moved likewise, and the new banks were becoming an increasing source of competition to the New York power center. By 1896, the number of non-national banks had grown to 61%, and they already held 54% of the country's total banking deposits. By 1913, the year in which the Federal Reserve Act was passed, those numbers had swelled to 71% non-national banks holding 57% of the nation's deposits. Something had to be done to stop this movement. Additional competition was developing from the trend in industry to finance itself from profits rather than borrowed capital. Between 1900 and 1910, 70% of American corporate growth was funded internally, making industry increasingly independent of the banks. What the bankers wanted, and what many businessmen wanted also, was a more flexible or elastic money supply, which would allow them to create enough of it at any point in time so as to be able to drive interest rates downward at will. That would make loans to businessmen so attractive they would have little choice but to return to the banker's stable. Trusts and cartels replace competition. One more problem facing Wall Street was the fact that the biggest investment houses, such as Morgan & Company and Kuhn Loeb & Company, although they remained as competitors, were by this time so large they had ceased doing serious battle against each other. The concept of trusts and cartels had dawned in America, and to those who already had made it to the top, joint ventures, market sharing, price fixing, and mergers were far more profitable than free enterprise competition. Ron Chernow explains, Wall Street was snowballing into one big Morgan-dominated institution. In December 1909, Pierpont had bought a majority stake in the Equitable Life Assurance Society from Thomas Fortune Ryan. This gave him strong influence over America's three biggest insurance companies, Mutual Life, Equitable, and New York Life. His Bankers Trust had taken over three other banks. In 1909, he had gained control of Guaranty Trust, which through a series of mergers he converted into America's largest trust. The core money trust group included J.P. Morgan & Company, First National Bank, and National City Bank. Wall Street bankers incestuously swapped seats on each other's boards. Some banks had so many overlapping directors it was hard to separate them. The banks also shared large equity stakes in each other. Why didn't banks just merge instead of carrying out the charade of swapping shares and board members? Most were private partnerships or closely held banks and could have done so. The answer harked back to traditional American antipathy against concentrated financial power. The Morgan, First National, National City trio feared public retribution if it openly declared its allegiance. Interlocking directorates and other forms of hidden control were far more safe than open consolidation, but they too had their limitations. For one thing, they could not penetrate the barriers of similar competitive groupings. As these combines became larger and larger, ways were sought to bring them together at the top rather than to capture the corporate entities which comprised them. Thus was born the concept of a cartel, a community of interest among businessmen in the same field, a mechanism for coming together as partners at a high level and to reduce or eliminate altogether the harsh necessity of competition. All cartels, however, have an internal self-destruct mechanism. Sooner or later, one of the members inevitably becomes dissatisfied with his agreed-upon piece of the pie. He decides to compete once again and seeks a greater share of the market. It was quickly recognized that the only way to prevent this from happening was to use the police power of government to enforce the cartel agreement. The procedure called for the passage of laws disguised as measures to protect the consumer, but which actually worked to ensure the elimination of competition. Henry P. Davison, who was a Morgan partner, put it bluntly when he told a congressional committee in 1912, "I would rather have regulation and control than free competition." John D. Rockefeller was even more to the point in one of his often repeated comments. Competition is a sin. This trend was not unique to the banking industry. Ron Paul and Lewis Lerman provide the historical perspective. After 1896 and 1900, then, America entered a progressive and predominantly Republican era. Compulsory cartelization in the name of progressivism began to invade every aspect of American economic life. The railroads had begun the parade with the formation of the ICC in the 1880s, but now field after field was being centralized and cartelized in the name of efficiency, stability, progress, and the general welfare. In particular, various big business groups led by the J.P. Morgan interests often gathered in the National Civic Federation and other think tanks and pressure organizations saw that the voluntary cartels and the industrial merger movements of the late 1890s had failed to achieve monopoly prices in industry. Therefore, they decided to turn to governments, state and federal, to curb the winds of competition and to establish forms of compulsory cartels, in the name, of course, of curbing big business monopoly and advancing the general welfare. The challenge no longer was how to overcome one's adversaries, but how to keep new ones from entering the field. When John D. used his enormous profits from Standard Oil to take control of the Chase National Bank, and his brother William bought the National City Bank of New York, Wall Street had yet one more gladiator in the financial arena. Morgan found that he had no choice except to allow the Rockefellers into the club. But now that they were in, they all agreed that the influx of competitors had to be stopped. And that was to be the hidden purpose of federal legislation and government control. Gabriel Kolko explains. The sheer magnitude of many of the mergers, culminating in U.S. Steel, soon forced him, Morgan, to modify his stand, though at times he would have preferred total control. More important, by 1898 he could not ignore the massive power of new financial competitors and had to treat them with deference. Standard Oil Company, utilizing National City Bank for its investments, had fixed resources substantially larger than Morgan's, and by 1899 was ready to move into the general economy. The test came, of course, in the Northern Securities battle, which was essentially an expensive draw. Morgan and Standard paid deference to each other thereafter, and mutual toleration among bankers increased sharply. A benign armed neutrality, rather than positive affection, is as much a reason as any for the high number of interlocks among the five major New York banking houses. Writing in the year 1919, from the perspective of an inside view of Wall Street at that time, John Moody completes the picture. This remarkable welding together of great corporate interests could not, of course, have been accomplished if the masters of capital in Wall Street had not themselves, during the same period, become more closely allied. The rivalry of interests, which was so characteristic during the reorganization period a few years before, had very largely disappeared. Although the two great groups of financiers, represented on the one hand by Morgan and his allies, and on the other by the Standard Oil forces, were still distinguishable, they were now working in practical harmony on the basis of a sort of mutual community of interest of their own. Thus, the control of capital and credit through banking resources tended to become concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer men. Before long, it could be said, indeed, that two rival banking groups no longer existed, but that one vast and harmonious banking power had taken their place. The Aldrich-Vreeland Act. The monetary contractions of 1879 and 1893 were handled by Wall Street fairly easily and without government intervention. But the crisis of 1907 pushed their resources close to the abyss. It became clear that two changes had to be made. All remnants of banking competition now had to be totally eliminated and replaced by a national cartel, and far greater sums of fiat money had to be made available to the banks to protect them from future runs by depositors. There was now no question that Congress would have to be brought in as a partner in order to use the power of government to accomplish these objectives. Kolko continues, "The crisis of 1907, on the other hand, found the combined banking structure of New York inadequate to meet the challenge. and chastened any obstreperous financial powers who thought they might build their fortunes independently of the entire banking community. The nation had grown too large. Banking had become too complex. Wall Street, humbled and almost alone, turned from its own resources to the national government. The first step in this direction was openly a stopgap measure. In 1908, Congress passed the Aldrich-Vreeland Act, which basically accomplished two objectives. First, it authorized the national banks to issue an emergency currency called script to substitute for regular money when they found themselves unable to pay their depositors. Script had been used by the bank clearinghouses during the panic of 1907 with partial success, but it had been a bold experiment with no legal foundation. Now Congress made it quite legal, and, as Galbraith observed, the new legislation regularized these arrangements. This could be done against the security of sundry bonds and commercial loans. These could, in effect, be turned into cash without being sold. The second and perhaps most important feature of the Act was to create a National Monetary Commission to study the problems of American banking and then make recommendations to Congress on how to stabilize the monetary system. The commission consisted of 9 senators and 9 representatives. The vice chairman was Representative Edward Vreeland, a banker from the Buffalo area. The chairman, of course, was Senator Nelson Aldrich. From the start, it was obvious that the commission was a sham. Aldrich conducted virtually a one-man show. The so-called fact-finding body held no official meetings for almost 2 years, while Aldrich toured Europe consulting with the top central bankers of England, France, and Germany. 300,000 tax dollars were spent on these junkets, and the only tangible product of the commission's work was 38 massive volumes of the history of European banking. None of the members of the commission were ever consulted regarding the official recommendations issued by Aldrich in their name. Actually, these were the work of Aldrich and 6 men who were not even members of the commission, and their report was drafted not in a bare congressional conference room in Washington, but in a plush private hunting resort in Georgia. And this event finally brings us back to that cold, blustery night at the New Jersey railway station, where 7 men, representing 1/4 of the wealth of the world, boarded the Aldrich private car for a clandestine journey to Jekyll Island. The Jekyll Island Plan. As summarized in the opening chapter of this book, the purpose of that meeting was to work out a plan to achieve 5 primary objectives. 1. Stop the growing influence of small rival banks and to ensure that control over the nation's financial resources would remain in the hands of those present. 2. Make the money supply more elastic in order to reverse the trend of private capital formation and to recapture the industrial loan market. 3. Pool the meager reserves of all the nation's banks into one large reserve, so that at least a few of them could protect themselves from currency drains and bank runs. 4. Shift the inevitable losses from the owners of the banks to the taxpayers. 5. Convince Congress that the scheme was a measure to protect the public. It was decided that the first 2 objectives could be achieved simply by drafting the proper technical language into a cartel agreement and then reworking the vocabulary into legislative phraseology. The 3rd and 4th could be achieved by including in that legislation the establishment of a lender of last resort, in other words, a true central bank with the ability to create unlimited amounts of fiat money. These were mostly technical matters, and although there was some disagreement on a few minor points, generally they were content to follow the advice of Paul Warburg, the man who had the most experience in these matters, and who was regarded as the group's theoretician. The 5th objective was the critical one, and there was much discussion on how to achieve it. To convince Congress and the public that the reestablishment of a banking cartel was somehow a measure to protect the public, the Jekyll Island strategists laid down the following plan of action. 1. Do not call it a cartel, nor even a central bank. 2. Make it look like a government agency. 3. Establish regional branches to create the